British Public Radio. Literature.
Adventures of Words is brought to you by Audible. Try Audible free for 30 days and download any audiobook for free. For your free trial, go to www.adventureswithwords.com/audible.
Hello, once Adventures with Words, where we explore storytelling in all its forms. I'm Rob.
I'm Kate.
And this week is part two of our look at the long list for the Man Booker Prize 2013.
Now, originally we thought we were going to be talking to you about six samples today, but it turns out that, in fact, the sample of The Lowland by Jhumpa Lahiri has literally just become available. So we've done a very quick bit of final reading for you. So we've actually now got the complete long list of, in terms of samples, that we can chat through with you today.
Just in case you missed Larkspeed's episodes, I think the ones that we preferred the most were definitely The Luminaries.
Yeah, we both agreed on that one.
Harvest by Jim Crace.
Yeah, we both really liked that too.
We were intrigued by The Kills.
Yeah, that's fair to say. Not quite 100% sure, but yeah, definitely intriguing.
And we couldn't quite agree on the others, but you, as it went on, I think you preferred The Marrying of Charney Kaufman.
Yeah, I sort of changed my mind because I really did like We Need New Names by Violet Bulawayo. Just, I really liked the kind of narrative voice with Darling, who's this quite young child and her friends in the slum. Mm. And, you know, they it's very fun, very bright. But then I think The Marrying of Charney Kaufman was really interesting. All the, you know, we were talking about it, all the kind of traditions that they have, which, in some ways the situation is very familiar, but then in some ways they were very, very different to what we experienced ourselves. And it was written in a very fun way. Mm. Despite the fact that some of these things would have been pretty stressful.
Oh, I liked Charney, that'd be a very different film, that would. Charney Kaufman, I really liked. I was quite drawn with Five Star Billionaire as well, which you weren't too keen on the potential message of that. But, you know, we are just reading the samples, so it's kind of a sort of slight snap judgment. Do we basically want to carry on reading these books?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we've got seven more to do, and then we'll try and pick the shortlist, which comes out on the Tuesday, I believe. So if we start with, why don't you kick us off with The Lowland?
Okay, so this is the one that we read most recently, and it's set in a place called Tollygunge, which is an interesting start to begin with, if you're the kind of person who thinks about the names of places. And this is somewhere that was created by British colonial people just outside Calcutta, and it was supposed to be somewhere that they could escape from the business of the town. But then we're sort of coming to the story in sort of the mid to late 1940s, and at that point the British people have mainly gone away again. There's quite a large Muslim population. It talks about partition. Mm. So there's lots of the kind of historical background of that time in India, Bengal, Pakistan. That's quite interesting to me to start with. And we've got two brothers, and they're sort of a year or so different in age. They're quite different in temperament, but they're incredibly similar in appearance. So they often get muddled up, even though they behave so differently. They're kind of hanging out together. And the older brother, who's Subhash, he's a bit more cautious, but the younger brother is a lot more brave and sort of outspoken and so on. So it's kind of an adventure that they have. They break into the kind of country club, which is still a sort of very British preserve.
Well, they want to play golf, don't they?
Yeah. I think one of the guys who works as a caddy there has kind of told them all these stories about what it's like. And obviously it's made it sound quite exciting.
Well, they're fascinated by just the neatly cut grass and the sand pits, and it's obviously quite an alien sort of landscape if you think about it.
Yeah, it's sort of very luxurious, all these sort of lovely egrets everywhere and the jackals, and so it's very exotic, which sounds funny because they've gone from the, you know, very Indian surroundings to almost the kind of British preserve, and they found that really exotic. Mm. But yeah, fair enough.
Well, I like this one. I mean, it was straight out of my dissertation era.
Yeah, I was wondering what you were going to say about that.
I read a lot
actually.
Of post-colonial, especially Indian literature. So this is sort of Midnight's Children sort of ish. So the lowland of the title, now that's an area that floods quite near them, I think.
Yeah.
It's quite fertile land. Yep. So I'm thinking, you know, things obviously going to grow. We do follow the boys as they go on. They both get into university, which their parents are quite proud of. Both on very technical. They're technically adept, aren't they? They can they build things.
Yeah.
They learn
Morse code. Sort of very scientific minds.
Yeah. And that's kind of where we leave the story for the sample. So I really liked it. I'd like to quietly carry on reading this one.
Yeah, I thought the way in which their world was created, they didn't spend loads of time, or Junpei here, I should say, doesn't spend loads of time in descriptive passages, but the way that it is described, I think, makes it feel very vivid. We spend more of the time with the boys as they, you know, they go to school, they play with each other. There's the little anecdotes about them, but through the way that the anecdotes are told, I think you get a very well-rounded view of the place that they're living, their family, their teachers, the, you know, their hometown. And I thought it was really interesting. It was, I suppose, quite light, quite funny again.
There was a bit where when they're caught sneaking into the golf club and they're basically beaten by a policeman, which is a bit...
Well, he whacks the older brother around the back of the legs, doesn't he?
And they'd never been beaten by their parents before. So I'm intrigued. I think we'll see these two grow up, and no doubt India's history will play out. Anyone who knows sort of what happens in that time. Yeah, I'm quite happy to keep reading that one, I think.
Yeah, I was really intrigued by it. It wasn't necessarily a particularly long sample, but it was very interesting. Mm.
So if we move on to the next on the list, which is Unexploded by Alison MacLeod, a compelling novel of love and prejudice in wartime Brighton.
Mm-hmm.
May 1940, on Park Crescent, Geoffrey and Evelyn Beaumont and their 8-year-old son Philip anxiously await news of the expected enemy landing on the beaches of Brighton. It's a year of tension and change. Geoffrey becomes superintendent of the enemy alien camp at the far reaches of town, while Philip is gripped by the rumour that Hitler will make Brighton's Royal Pavilion his English headquarters. As the rumours continue to fly and the days tick on, Evelyn struggles to fall in with the war effort and the constraints of her role in life, and her thoughts become tinged with a mounting, indefinable desperation. Then she meets Otto Gottlieb, a degenerate German-Jewish painter and prisoner in her husband's internment camp. As Europe crumbles, Evelyn and Otto's mutual distrust slowly begins to change into something else, which will shatter the structures on which her life, her family, and her community rest. Love collides with fear, the power of art with the forces of war, and the lives of Evelyn, Otto, and Geoffrey are changed irrevocably.
Now, I have to say, that blurb gives a very different impression than the one that I got from reading the opening of the book. Mm. That sounds a lot more interesting.
Yes, you weren't too keen on this one from what you read.
No.
I quite liked it. Up to the point that we've read, we certainly don't know that her husband is in charge of the internment camp. Now, when we meet Geoffrey, he's running a bank.
Yeah. I think he's working for the Bank of England.
I think so. Well, that's partly what intrigued me, because you living in Brighton, there's a certain fear that at any point there's going to be a crossing over the Channel.
Which actually is something that I hadn't really thought about.
No,
but
I
of
never
course,
had.
It does make perfect sense.
There's a fear of invasion. They can sort of, sometimes the windows vibrate with explosions. Oil is washing up on the shore. There's a sort of rescue and landing craft going on. I thought that was quite atmospheric. The bit with Geoffrey talking about the bank, I'd literally never heard of. The fact that they were planning to bury bits of money, they were going to take it abroad, and anything they couldn't move, they were going to burn.
Mm.
So you sort of think of the war as being desperate times, but I guess they were thinking, well, if they're invaded, they don't want Hitler to have money to spend or something. But I found that fascinating, that I'd never thought of Brighton and what it'd be like living there across the Channel, and also never thought of the banks. And then we sort of a bit of Evie, her childhood, where she would go out into the garden to read while her father was yelling and screaming at her mother. So you kind of got a bit to know it. You weren't too keen on her, though.
No, and I suppose perhaps this is kind of going back to my own sort of prejudice, where I'm not always that keen on novels about women's lives.
Mm.
And just from reading the sample, I was a bit worried that this was going to be a novel about this woman's life. And it was it was just so kind of domestic at the beginning.
Right.
And I don't necessarily particularly enjoy that.
I suppose it was because she's talking about they've got rid of their maid. She's having to do the cooking.
Yeah.
And she has to get home before her son returns from school.
Yeah.
I didn't feel that way, but I guess I was thinking Unexploded. I got this feeling of something possibly bubbling under at any point, ready to go off. This sense of war. I thought Geoffrey would be leaving, because he says he has to leave with money, but you're never quite sure where she's going. And then he, obviously from the blurb, he's running this internment camp. So I'm intrigued. I probably would, given the choice, carry on.
See, I think perhaps if the sample was a bit longer and I'd seen that something more was going to happen, then I would be more positive about it. But you know, if we are going to do this from purely reading the sample, then actually her reaction to him having to go away really put me off, that she just seems to completely fall apart. And that I found that a bit depressing, that she seems to be so reliant on this sort of routine and her husband coming home to her and, you know, okay, not now she has to cope with cooking and she didn't used to have to do that before. Yeah. And, you know, she sort of says how she's proud that she isn't like her parents. But actually, I thought, well, I think you actually are more like them than you think you are, because this idea of being on coping for herself, having to cook for herself and her son, all that is awful. And I thought, oh, God, she just seemed so wet. She seemed to just fall apart at the idea that her husband might have to go away for a bit. And I thought, really, come on, you know, you're a grown-up, you're a perfectly capable human being. Kind of stick up for yourself a bit more.
Well, I guess they're in a sort of a place of privilege. I think he obviously earns quite a bit.
Well, a reasonable amount, but it does make it quite clear that he isn't... you know, of what her parents consider reasonable means. You know, they are kind of making a middle class life, whereas her parents were from home and they've got this massive house and her mother didn't have to work and, you know. And
I just got the impression with her there was something else that we didn't know. Something, I just don't know what, that just wasn't it. So, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think I found it frustrating because everyone likes a reading heroine and, you know, that was, that sort of gave me a bit of hope that she was going out to read in the garden while her parents argued or her dad went over and over his views yet again in the direction of her mother, which is fine. And I thought, oh, goody, you know, that's like sort of Jane Austen or something, Northanger Abbey, you know. But then... Yeah, she just seemed really wet. I don't know. But, yeah, I mean, if I'd had a chance to read further, I might have got more of an impression that actually she wasn't so wet. But I just, yeah, it just really put me off, I'm afraid.
Oh, well, let's move on to the next one, which is Transatlantic by Colin McCann. 1919, Emily Ehrlich watches as two young airmen, Alcock and Brown, emerge from the carnage of the First World War to pilot the very first non-stop transatlantic flight from Newfoundland to the west of Ireland. Among the letters being carried on the aircraft is one which will not be opened for almost 100 years. 1998, Senator George Mitchell crisscrosses the ocean in search of an elusive Irish peace. How many more bereaved mothers and grandmothers must he meet before an agreement can be reached? 1845. Frederick Douglass, a black American slave, lands in Ireland to champion ideas of democracy and freedom, only to find a famine unfurling at his feet. On his travels, he inspires a young maid to go to New York to embrace a free world, but the land does not always fulfill its promises for her. From the violent battlefields of the Civil War to the ice lakes of northern Missouri, it is the youngest daughter, Emily, who eventually finds her way back to Ireland. Can we pass from the new world to the old? How does the past shape the future? In Transatlantic, Colin McCann has achieved an outstanding act of literary bravura. Intricately crafted, poetic and deeply affecting, it weaves together personal stories to explore the fine line between what is real and what is imagined and the tangled connections that make up our lives.
Now, I like this a lot more, I have to say. I really
did. Completely.
I really enjoyed the story of the two airmen, the way that they were sort of almost like rehabilitating themselves after both having an appalling time in the war.
Well, the very first,
you know, doing this adventurous flight. And
well, the very first part is actually in 2012.
Yeah,
it's literally a page and a half, possibly. It's this image of it's a cottage with a slate roof, and seagulls are swooping down and trying to break oysters on the roof. Then it goes back to 1919 with Alcock and Brown. Alcock's the pilot and Brown is the navigator. So yeah, I really like this. We only saw the part in 1919 where they're trying to make the transatlantic flight. But obviously, this has got to do a lot with crossing and things starting. And so, yes, this idea that they're fought in the war and this is their chance for a clean slate. They're sort of starting.
Absolutely.
They're trying to start again. So I liked it. I thought it had a spirit of adventure. I could quite happily read an entire book about those two.
Yeah, you know, I was slightly disappointed that there wasn't going to be more of them, to be honest, because I really liked them. I thought they were great characters. What they were doing was really interesting, and they're sort of building up this impression that there's sort of a bit of competition going on between the sort of various different groups who are all trying to do this at the same time. There's a guy in London who's having a panic because there seems to be a German who might might be able to do it
first. This is Lord Northcliffe, the proprietor of the Daily Mail. Yes. He's terrified that there's going to be a German victory. And even the two pilots, they, as they're packing to get ready, they take a razor blade so they can shave and look presentable for their British victory as they land. I liked it. There, even just in this short little section, there are some nice little motifs that I liked when they're building the runway, I suppose, for the plane. They're having to blast bits so that it's destroying something to create something new. I liked the idea that they're asked a question. There's this journalist and her daughter. One of the questions asked is, by taking this first ever transatlantic flight, you're suddenly making the world a lot smaller.
Yeah.
But doing it in one go. Radio can suddenly link us all together, but now literally you can do it in one flight. The world shrunk, and I suppose we take that for granted these days, but yeah.
There was an image that I really liked, which was where they were doing their night flight, and to mark out the edges of the runway, they'd used candles in with paper bag covers, and they're all sort of scattered, and you've got these little sort of sputtering flames as the paper bags catch light as they land, and I just thought that was a really lovely image.
Well, then everyone has to rush forward to put the flames out.
Yeah,
I liked it. This idea that they were going to take off on Friday the 13th, which is a day of doom, and then they're going to try and cheat it.
Yeah, that they were sort of reclaiming it from bad luck, that this was a kind of typically airman thing to do. I thought, yeah, the way that the characters were evoked, you got snippets of history, but it was also to do with the way that you could read their personality from their appearance, to do with the way that they interacted with each other. You know, very sort of delicate little bits of description dropped in amongst everything else. And they seemed really interesting characters. And I think having all those other groups that who we didn't get to meet, I really like that idea of having the theme that runs through each of those stories. And it's to do with movement, change, trying to reclaim something that's been lost. And is that actually possible? You know, I really like that idea of those themes sort of interweaving through and linking the characters together.
Well, I think we can agree that we both enjoyed that one then.
Yeah, absolutely.
So next up is Almost English by Charlotte Mendelssohn. Home is a foreign country. They do things differently there. In a tiny flat in West London, 16-year-old Marina lives with her emotionally delicate mother, Laura, and three ancient Hungarian relatives. Imprisoned by her family's crushing expectations and their fierce un-English pride, by their strange traditions and stranger foods, she knows she must escape. But the place she runs to makes her feel even more of an outsider. At Combe Abbey, a traditional English public school for which her family have sacrificed everything, she realises she has made terrible mistakes. She's the awkward half-foreign girl who doesn't know how to fit in, flirt, or even be. As a semi-Hungarian Londoner, who is she? In the meantime, her mother Laura, an alien in this strange universe, has her own painful secrets to deal with, especially the return of the last man she expects back in her life. She isn't noticing that, at Combe Abbey, things are starting to go terribly wrong.
Now, this is probably one of my favourites of this half, this group of the longlisters. I thought the Hungarian characters are so funny.
And the way they talk, the way it's written down and spelt out for you on the page, you can hear the accents.
Yeah, and I mean, there is sort of a glossary at the back where some of the words that are used are actually sort of Hungarian words and a pronunciation guide. But a lot of the time, the way that the Hungarian dialogue is written, it's to show you that the emphasis is really on the first syllable and then everything else kind of runs together. So they'd say, wonderful.
It was a bit camp from Sesame Street, but I liked it.
But, you know, that's where he's supposed to be from, actually, isn't it? Yeah. So if you think about it, it would be a bit like that.
What did you think of Marina? Now, I haven't been a teenage girl, but did it sound authentic?
Yeah, definitely. And I don't think she's alone in the way that she feels. Mm. And I thought that was very well done. That it sort of opens really with her and her mum trying to choose something that she's going to feel like she looks nice in. And it's just hopeless. Mm. And everything she chooses just seems to be awful. And at one point, she even suggests wearing her school jumper because at least that's smart. Mm. Sort of thing. And she just feels desperately unattractive, freckly, that she doesn't fit in, that somehow by moving to Combe Abbey, which she thought was going to be wonderful, actually the situation is now worse, because at least at her normal, at her previous secondary school, she and her friends were all kind of in it together. But now not only does she feel terribly awkward and out of place, she's actually new as well.
Yeah.
So it's kind of really compounded. I felt terribly sorry for her. I thought the characters were really well written. They had a lot of depth. They felt, although, you know, they weren't necessarily happy, they were still thinking and active and not accepting of the things that were going wrong with them necessarily. They knew they had to do something. They just didn't quite know what. Mm. Which, although, you know, earlier when we were talking about Unexploded, I said I don't necessarily like books about women's lives.
Yeah.
Of course, this is exactly a book about women's lives and three generations worth, and all Rabbit's friends and relations. Mm. So, but it just struck a completely different chord with me. I thought it was very affectionately done, that kind of, you know, a little bit tongue in cheek, a bit poking fun, but also very sympathetic, also actually quite moving in places, thinking about all the kind of trials and tribulations that they were going through. And it's absolutely believable. Mm. I thought
I liked it. Yes, I could relate to Marina. We've all been 16 years old, we've all been at school trying to fit in, and she there's a boy that she likes, and she, oh, does he like me? We've all kind of been in that
situation. I love the bit where she's sort of thinking, well, how can he not know? I've stared at him enough. Yeah. And I thought, yeah, that's so wonderful.
I liked the it starts off with the family gathering, everyone's coming around, it's for the great grandmother's 80th birthday party. We've all been to parties where relatives are there that you haven't seen, and it's always, oh, what are you doing? And they're always, basically the interrogation that you get.
Yeah.
From the now her mum, she's very much sort of out of place. She's not Hungarian, so she's married into the family. Now there's a thing about the father's gone missing.
Yeah, Peter, who it's not, I think it's a grandmother rather than great grandmother.
Yes. Yeah,
Peter, who is that lady's son, got her pregnant and married her, but now he's gone off. He's disappeared somewhere.
I thought to start off with he died. It turns out he's just sort of vanished. I'm assuming from the blurb that he's the one that comes back.
He might well
be. Complicate things.
Yeah.
She's working at a doctor's surgery and having an affair with the doctor, who is coming to the party with
his
wife.
Or he's supposed to be, anyway.
Yes, supposed to be coming. So
his wife being Hungarian.
Hungarian. So, yeah, there's a nice little bit of still some intrigue. What's happened to the father? He's obviously going to come back. And I just found that I liked Marina. I felt sorry for Laura. I liked her. I thought the elder ladies that were actually quite entertaining.
Absolutely. Yeah. I really liked all the details, the things to do with the clothes, the things that all the food, all these kind of weird and wonderful dishes. And, you know, just I could imagine myself there and kind of every surface covered with cakes or cold meat or pickles or salads, or
which it's not going to get eaten, so there's
and they, you know, it says how they're all staying later and later and because there's still more food to eat, and they've all brought these massive boxes of chocolates from God knows where on the continent somewhere, and you know that these really quite old people are having this kind of crazy party. It sounded like good fun to me.
It was, so I think I liked it. Once again, it's set in London, so it's just another sort of, a bit like The Marrying of Charlie Kaufman. It's another side of our own country that I certainly aren't used to. Do you want to do the next one? Because you've actually bought this one.
Yeah, I even though I hadn't actually read the sample at the time, I went out and bought A Tale for the Time Being by Ruth Ezeki, on the strength of the fact that, I mean, A, it had been put on the book along list, B, that it was the winner of the Independent Booksellers Week Book Award 2013, but also that quite a few people had said how much they'd enjoyed it. So if I just read you it's only got a very short blurb on the back. It says, within the pages of this book lies the diary of a girl called Now. Riding the waves of a tsunami, it's making its way across the ocean. It will change the life of the person who finds it. It might just change yours too.
Mm.
So very brief, quite mysterious blurb. Rob, what did you think of it?
I really liked it. It switches sort of perspectives between Now, N-A-O, and someone called Ruth. Now is, she describes herself as a time being, which, you know, raised my eyebrows. And she's writing basically what we're reading to an extent in a French maid cafe in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
She's a schoolgirl, and she's sort of playing with writing, playing with sort of knowing that we're going to read this.
Yeah.
And she imagines this sort of potential futures for herself, something quite horrifically violent. And she's imagining talking to one of the other customers in the cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a 104-year-old great-grandmother who's a Zen Buddhist nun. And so she's saying that she's going to be writing her story.
Mm-hmm.
And then it switches to Ruth, which I think is Now.
I think so.
Now, yeah. And she something glints on the beach, catches her eye, and she brings in a bag, takes it home with her. And once her husband opens it, it's a Hello Kitty lunchbox. And
very kawaii.
Inside is a watch and what turns out to be this diary, but it's hidden inside a Marcel Proust French book. It's got the cover from Marcel Proust, and then inside the pages have been taken out. So
Ruth says when she opens it, the shock, she almost feels sort of sick at the shock of seeing this purple gel pen, because she thinks this book's like been defaced or something at first, which I totally understand.
Got the pink scrawl of a 17-year-old girl inside. I liked it. I found both of them quite interesting characters. Nao's very funny. She's very confident. Ruth describes herself as a novelist, so I was straight away thinking, is that Ruth Ezeki? Perhaps. It was quirky enough, funny enough, and well written to really want me to carry on and find out what on earth's going on.
I really liked this one. I'm really glad that I did, considering that I bought it. But I thought there were lots of things about it which really grabbed my interest. I really like reading Japanese fiction in translation, and so a lot of those sort of slang terms that she uses I was kind of already familiar with. So
I literally was thinking I'm gonna have to some of them I knew of, I might have to go and look them up. But
like she talks about going and talking to this other guy who's there in the French maid cafe. If you don't know, there's sort of areas of the big cities, particularly Tokyo, where she refers to it as like Electric City, I think, and it's sort of an area with lots and lots of bars and nightclubs, lots of themed cafes, which to us might seem a bit sleazy, perhaps. So this is a kind of a French maid cafe. So the idea is all the waitresses are dressed up as French maids, and they'll almost act like a maid to you.
Well, they feed you, don't they?
So you can pay for just the food and a drink, or you can pay for these services. And then, you know, she mentions there's like schoolgirl cafes. There's all sorts of different themes.
This is a fad that's sort of on its way out.
So the French maid ones aren't as popular anymore. And she describes him as, I think, otaku, which means like a sort of middle range business worker who probably comes into the city and then goes out of the city again. And she talks about, she uses this phrase hentai, which means someone who's into kind of kinky, maybe sort of a bit S&M sort of sex stuff.
Anime. Yeah.
Yeah. But she uses it as a description of a person as opposed to necessarily a thing. So like she says, I'm not hentai, for example. I assume there was certainly in my Kindle sample, there were sort of highlighted bits where it looked like you can go and look up what that was if you didn't know.
Yes, there's also Japanese script and emoticons, little smiley faces.
Which I quite, I really like sort of that sort of really quirky Japanese culture. I do think it's really interesting because you've got people who are very young, like Nao, and she's very aware of what we might consider quite adult things, not necessarily appropriate for people of her age to be aware of. But there is that kind of acceptance that people of quite a young age are aware of these things and sometimes choose to get involved in them, although she says that she doesn't. But she obviously is very aware of what's going on around her. And that kind of meta level to it all, that is Ruth in the other half, is that Ruth Ezeki? Did she really find this diary? Are we supposed to think she's kind of fictionalizing something that really happened? And you know, it's playing with the idea of the fact that when we had the recent Japanese tsunami, a lot of things were washed across the Pacific and ended up washing up on the coasts of America, Canada, and so on. So you know, that is a real phenomenon, and they actually talk about it. She discusses it with her husband in the book, and that perhaps this is just happening a bit faster than what they expected. So she's found this diary. But then why did Nao package that all together in the Hello Kitty lunchbox and wrap it up so carefully in all the layers of plastic bags and chuck it in the sea, or allow it to be washed away? And, you know, she says, I haven't got very much longer left.
Yes, so it seems to be like she's counting.
Why not? Because she's only 16. So there's quite a lot of mystery there as well. I really liked Nao's kind of awareness of her audience. There were lots and lots of elements that I really enjoyed about it. It made me really curious.
Yeah, I'm intrigued. I want to carry on reading. I I liked spending time with Now and her grandmother, and also with Ruth, and presumably she's going to explore what Now is doing. So, yeah, there's a lot, that's potential. I really would like to carry on reading that one, and I'm glad we've got a copy. Yeah. So another one we've got a copy of is Spinning Heart by Donald Ryan.
In the aftermath of Ireland's financial collapse, dangerous tensions surface in an Irish town. As violence flares, the characters face a battle between public persona and inner desires. Through a chorus of unique voices, each struggling to tell their own kind of tale, a single, authentic tale unfolds. The Spinning Heart speaks for contemporary Ireland like no other novel. Wry, vulnerable, all too human, it captures the language and spirit of rural Ireland and with uncanny perception articulates the words and thoughts of a generation. Technically daring and evocative of Patrick McCabe and J.M. Synge, this novel of small town life is witty, dark and sweetly poignant. Do you agree?
From the extract that we read, it didn't grab me particularly.
It was a very short extract. Mm,
that's probably the problem. Some of these are very, very short extracts. And
I think, and we said last week that where it's a longer novel, we've had a much longer extract. But, I mean, the Spinning Heart is one of the shortest, and the extract is tiny, really short.
So I'd need to read more to make a valid judgment. But from what I have read and what they're obviously giving away for people to potentially try before they buy is... didn't capture my attention particularly.
No, it kind of, I mean, that image of the spinning heart, I think, is really interesting because, you know, perhaps it's referring to this idea of the difference between what you actually feel and what you feel that you can say to other people. But then straight away, it talks about this metal heart, which is in his on the front gate of his father's like front garden. And so it seems to have immediately explained that without any kind of...
Well, I found the first sentence quite attention-grabbing because it's talking about he goes to his father's and in the hope that his father's died.
Yeah.
And then you quickly realise that, well, they're not getting on. His father seems to revel in the fact that his son is just lost his job and he wants to basically... When his father dies, he wants to burn the cottage down and sell off the land and, you know, scorched earth almost, move on.
Yeah.
It turns out he's just been let go from his job. He's been scammed by someone called Pokey Burke, who has been employing a number of people but hasn't been paying their national insurance. Or basically, he's been fiddling the books.
Yeah.
And so you realise that there was this housing boom in Ireland and now that's all sort of faded away. Yeah, and he thinks of killing his father. So it was a few interesting ideas, but not really in a way that wanted me to carry on going. It's obviously a book that's got other voices in it, which may be a bit more interesting.
Which similarly to quite a few of the choices on the long list, actually. But yeah, I mean, I have to agree, to be honest. Perhaps it was just that there wasn't enough there to really kind of get your attention properly, but...
I know this has had rave reviews from people who obviously read the whole thing, so perhaps as a whole, but do you want to carry on? That's what we're asking.
And it didn't... If there's other things in front of it, then I would pick those over this. I think that's how I would put it. That, you know, I didn't think it was badly written. I thought it was very convincing in terms of this being this guy's kind of internal voice.
Yes, the dialogue and the dialect and just the general feel of it, I thought was very authentic, actually, and very well written. But nothing yet stoked a fire in me to want to carry on reading that, I'm afraid.
No, and in an odd sort of way, I felt almost it went too fast. That even in such a short sample, we've actually found out tons about this guy's life, but I would have liked to find it out in a bit more depth. I think
a bit of a pause and just,
you know,
a bit more.
Yeah, you know, we find out about the fact that, you know, he's been made redundant. We find out about him meeting Triona, his wife. That one of the other guys on the team kind of went nuts and sort of tried to smash in the door of the porter cabin where Pokey was hiding, and all this kind of. But you know, there's so many things that happen, but I didn't really feel like I actually got to know him that well, even though he told me so many things. It didn't go into anything in considering it's someone's internal voice in any particular emotional depth. I don't know. Perhaps that's, but I mean, again, it was a really short sample. So it is very hard to make a good judgment. As I say, you know, we've got a copy of the book, but we wanted to do it by reading the sample. So it was sort of the same for each one. But I think perhaps this is one that kind of suffers from that process a little bit.
One that's even shorter is the final one, Colm Tobin's The Testament of Mary.
I think that's the shortest book on the whole long list.
It says on the blurb, this is a short book, but it is as dense as a diamond. From the author of Brooklyn, in a voice that is both tender and filled with rage, The Testament of Mary tells the story of a cataclysmic event which led to an overpowering grief. For Mary, her son has been lost to the world, and now, living in exile and in fear, she tries to piece together the memories of the events that led to her son's brutal death. To her, he was a vulnerable figure, surrounded by men who could not be trusted, living in a time of turmoil and change. As her life and her suffering begin to acquire the resonance of myth, Mary struggles to break the silence surrounding what she knows to have happened. In her effort to tell the truth in all its gnarled complexity, she slowly emerges as a figure of immense moral stature and as a woman from history rendered now as fully human. Very and this sample was 7 or 8 pages, but even in that, I think we got quite a good idea of what's going on.
I think, again, it's first person. You're actually here, you know, when it says the Testament of Mary, it's literally she is speaking. And just in case anyone hasn't got it already, it's supposed to be the mother of Jesus.
And it starts with, so there is a man who, she's basically sort of dictating the story. There's a man who's writing it down. She can't actually read, so she's sort of hoping that what's going down.
Well, she's pretty sure that it isn't exactly what she said.
There are other men who are trying to silence her.
Mm-hmm. She describes one of them as the strangler.
Yeah, and there are little snippets. There's sort of flashbacks to on the hill with the crucifixes. There are men gambling for the clothes and things like that. So in quite a short amount of time, I felt that there was quite a lot in there. You really felt there's a lot of emotion on that page.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm not necessarily a particularly overtly religious person. I think a lot of, you know, we won't get into my stance on organized religion because that's not relevant right now. But I was brought up kind of going to, not church exactly, but going to kind of Christian meetings and things like this. And I've got quite a good knowledge of sort of Christianity and the Bible and things like that. And I get very emotional about things like this because I think it's one of the most tragic stories that there is in the world generally. It's an amazing story, and whether you think it literally happened or whether you think it's teaching stories or whether you think there was this guy who was just trying to do something good and the Romans didn't like it because he was a rebel, you know, whatever your view on it, or if it's all a load of rubbish, it's still an amazing story. It really is. So, you know, I'm always open, even if I'm not personally that religious, I'm always open to kind of new interpretations of it. I went and saw The Passion of the Christ at the cinema when that came out, which was absolutely brutal, an incredible film, actually, in terms of kind of putting the story across in a very physical way, which I think a lot of people don't think about it in that way. So Philip Pullman wrote a really good book, which I think is called like the Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ or something like that. And that was really, really interesting. The idea that perhaps there were two people and one of them actually just wanted to make a positive difference, but the other one kind of wanted acclaim and to become known. And so that was really interesting. And I think this is going to be another sort of thing in that vein where it's exploring sort of an untold story, a different perspective, because, you know, a mother is incredibly important to their children, and yet Mary hardly appears in any of the New Testament books once Jesus is grown up, basically, which seems bizarre.
The focus shifts, doesn't it? And I think perhaps this is basically what he's trying to do, is to shine a light more on Mary. I mean, she's possibly a forgotten figure into some respects. So I think I'm intrigued. What was she thinking when her son was doing all these things? Where was she? What was going on? It's only 114 pages, so it's not going to take a long read. But hopefully, from what we've read so far, I think it will be quite a moving, quite a intriguing, interesting take on things.
I hope it will be. I really do. I thought that even just those few pages that we read were very moving, actually. And I think also it's interesting the way that it's done. It doesn't mention the word Jesus. It doesn't say Christ. It doesn't say disciples or apostles or Romans or anything like that. So I think it's also trying to make it more universally applicable as well, that you don't necessarily have to know about the kind of biblical stories to be able to appreciate the sort of trials of a mother who's lost her son and so on.
Well, hopefully it's a story, and the religion is put to one side, and it's a story about people. So that is the list. So we chose some from the first half. Now, do you think you can we pick some out from this to put forward?
Well, are we going for a short list of 6 or 7?
I think they're actually going down to 6.
Okay, right.
I will put forward Transatlantic and A Tale for the Time Being as the ones that I enjoyed the most from these.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely enjoyed A Tale for the Time Being, and I thought Transatlantic was very good as well. Mm. But what about a third one? See, this is what we did last time as well. I think we both quite liked two. But then, what about a third? I mean,
I would put in The Lowland.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think so. That's just more my sort of thing. I think you possibly might want Almost English.
I did really enjoy Almost English, actually. I did think it was very funny, but also very, very sweet and very sympathetic as well. But then, I thought The Testament of Mary was very impressive, considering it was so short.
It's hard to judge both The Spinning Heart and The Testament of Mary on that, because they were so short. The Testament of Mary was very well, stood out for such a short extract.
Yeah.
It was very well done.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. I think, I'm not sure I can judge with The Testament of Mary until I read a bit more, because I read only read sort of 6 or 7 pages or whatever it was. So it was very hard to tell. So on that basis, I think I'll say Almost English, actually.
Right. Well, I've technically cheated, and I do have the bookies' favourites here.
Right, yeah, okay.
So we have got on the bookie. These are the bookies' favourites for the shortlist, which I think comes out on Tuesday. We've got The Luminaries.
Yes.
It's a fairly obvious one. The Kills by Richard House.
Mm-hmm.
Almost English by Charlotte Mendelssohn.
Hey.
The Testament of Mary and Transatlantic, with the bookies' favourite currently being Harvest by Jim Crace.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's
so actually, it is the ones that we picked out.
Yes. Basically, I know we had a bit of a trouble because we were doing 6. There had to be 3 from those. But
yeah.
I think if we were to jumble them together, now The Kills potentially, well, that's a huge book.
It is
massive. We did read quite a lot, and I think some people have said it sort of wanders slightly, but that's almost what we went for, I think.
It's pretty close, isn't it? I mean, I know I was kind of wavering between a couple, but, you know, the ones that we both agreed on are there. Mm. You know, we said The Luminaries, we said Harvest, we said Transatlantic. You know,
There aren't any there where I'm thinking, what on earth are they going on about?
No, I mean, in previous years, there have been a few where we have thought, oh my goodness, are you quite sure about that?
Well, The Kills stands out because there's technically a thriller, a crime thriller, but
except it's got a lot more depth.
It's got a lot more.
It's got
to
the
that.
Kind of political aspect of it. It's got the innovation where, you know, you can click on the little sort of film clips and so on.
I thought it was very well put together. It gave you a real sense of place. There was enough mystery going on to sort of drive you forward. The writing was quite sparse, but then that worked.
Yeah, I mean, it was totally appropriate for the content, definitely.
Mm. So in those odds, The Kills and Almost English are slightly further out
to
win it as such. But yeah, Jim Crace, he's being picked as the winner, a long overdue winner is what they're calling him.
Oh, one of those.
One of those.
So hopefully it's a Julian Barnes.
A Julian Barnes incident all over again. But no, from what we read from Harvest, we were quite impressed.
Yeah, well, I mean, I really liked Harvest an awful lot. Although I think The Luminaries is still my favourite overall.
Yeah.
But I'd be thrilled if it was Harvest. I would be absolutely thrilled.
Well, do please share your thoughts with us if you've read any of these Booker titles. We had some feedback from last week's episode.
Which is always nice.
Yep, that was Louise, who said that she'd just finished We Need New Names and was quite disappointed. I know this is one you were fairly interested in. She said it seemed like a series of disconnected events or situations, and she was missing a coherent story and thread all the way throughout. Didn't really care for the main character, darling.
Oh, a bit of a shame. But, I mean, it just goes to show, though, obviously, when you're just reading the sample, you don't quite know how it's going to pan out.
Mm. So do share your thoughts. So that was Louise leaving a comment on the blog at adventuresofwords.com. But if you want to get in touch through Twitter, we're on @WordAdventures. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/adventuresofwords. Or just send us an old-fashioned email, contact@adventuresofwords.com.
We'd love to hear from you. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, don't forget you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and you can even leave us a little review there as well.
So we'll put the shortlist up on the website once it's been announced.
I believe that's the 10th of September. Yeah.
As always, we'll be reading the winner when that's announced as well, so fingers crossed.
I really hope it's Harvest.
If it's any of those, I'm really not bothered.
Yeah, I know. I think there's a lot of books there that I'd be very happy to read this year.
I'm going to be reading The Luminaries and The Kills and possibly The Rupazeki. They'll be
I think
this.
Yeah, I think yep. Either way, I definitely want to read The Luminaries. I've already got The Rupazeki, and we've got a copy of Harvest as well, so I think whatever happens, I'm probably going to read those three.
Well, I've been Rob. You can find me on Twitter at Rob Chilver.
I've been Kate at @magic_kitten.
And thanks for listening.
Adventures with Words is brought to you by Audible. Try Audible free for 30 days and download any audiobook for free. For your free trial, go to www.adventureswithwords.com/audible.